Hello and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. Hi, I'm Ashwani and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
We're absolutely delighted to welcome Colin Green today to Brain Injury Bites. Colin is a neurological physiotherapist at Physio Matters in Oldham. Colin, would you perhaps like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Of course, and thank you very much for inviting me to come and speak today. It's a pleasure to just get the message out about neuro rehab and brain injury. My name is Colin Green. I qualified as a physiotherapist back in 1992 and worked in the NHS for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And then started to think that there was perhaps a little bit more that I could do for clients and that we could do for clients, and telling people that they'd achieve the potential when really there was so much more that could be done. So my real interest is in longer-term rehab, managing long-term conditions. So I feel really privileged now that we've got a fantastic team that were set up in 2000. So we've been going 23 years
now.
And we've got a team of 15 of us based up in North Manchester. And we provide treatment across the Northwest for people with acquired brain injury. So that may be traumatic brain injury, or a stroke, or a head injury, or Parkinson's, MS. So a wide range of conditions, but my particular interest is brain injury.
So you were in NHS practice beforehand. Was that more on a general physiotherapy sort of route? And what brought you into neurological physiotherapy?
That's a really good question, because initially when someone comes into physiotherapy, they feel they're going to be the physio for Manchester United. Everyone's going to be the physio for Man United. Or probably Man City now.
There are other football teams available.
When you first qualify as a physio, you do everything. So you go around every 3 months on a different speciality. And I soon realised that the areas I wanted to work in were longer term rehab. So it was neurological rehab, it was amputee rehab, it was complex orthopaedic trauma. So quite soon I started to specialise, which is fairly unusual. But then over my 8 year career, by the end of it, I was a senior one, which would now be a band 7 physiotherapist, setting up a community neuro rehab service in Oldham. But it felt like you could do so much more.
Yeah.
So yeah, in answer to your question, it is a general education to start off with and get more and more specialised. And I did my master's degree as well.
Yeah.
Since that, I went back into studying 15 years after qualifying.
Wow, okay.
That's the problem with brain injury, isn't it? Because it can keep, I don't know how to say this, but with the NHS, they can only take, due to, funding restrictions and so on, they can only take you so far. But it's one of those things you can keep having treatment for the rest of your life, really, because it's something that you have to live with.
It's not going away, is it?
Yeah, that's really good, Brooke, that it is that ongoing, it is a lifelong condition.
Yeah.
And there are different phases, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, different phases of treatment. But yeah, the problem doesn't go away, but a lot of the work is it's treatment, but it's also management of a condition. How do you manage your condition? How would you move forward with that condition? Mm-hmm. And certainly my experience of when I worked in the NHS back in the past was from a kind of the initial acute setting when someone's in intensive care is fantastic. But kind of after that, people who've had traumatic brain injury don't really sit anywhere in the hospital.
Mm.
So are they an orthopaedic injury? Probably. Mm. Are the psychological components? Definitely. Mm-hmm. Is it possibly psychiatric elements of it? Yeah, there could be. Are the behavioural issues? Quite possibly. Are there wider family issues? And how are all these different conditions? There may be respiratory issues. So it's kind of where does that patient at that point, where do they sit in the hospital? And it was always quite a difficult thing for someone who had a traumatic brain injury. Where do you put them?
Yeah, it's multifactorial. It's not a single issue, is it? And that kind of leads me a little bit to, just for the benefit of our listeners, if you could just explain the difference, or rather what neurological physio is, because I think most of us, when we think about physiotherapy, we do think like somebody's broken their leg, it's rehabilitating the mobility back into that, or arm, whatever. But how do you work with patients with traumatic or brain injuries or other neurological conditions? Is there a sort of an interplay between what's going on in the brain and the sort of physiological issues?
Certainly. I mean, the big overarching heading for the kind of brain injury rehab would be multidisciplinary. That it has to be. If you're a physiotherapist treating someone on your own with none of the other professions, you're going to probably struggle. And that's where we're really privileged now, that in every team we work in, there is a multidisciplinary team involved. But yeah, coming back to the, I suppose you could split it into three phases. So you've got the acute phase straight after your injury. So that's from ambulance to possible surgery, intensive care, through to high dependency and going on to the acute ward. So that will be the first phase. And the next phase will be the subacute. So you're still in hospital, but looking at plans to go home.
Mm-hmm.
So what's or to go wherever you're going to be going. And the third phase would be that chronic phase, which I don't really like. I'd rather use the word long term, that you're looking at how to manage someone's condition. And then you've possibly got a fourth phase of a kind of adjustment and condition management in the longer term. So if we discuss the acute phase to start off with, which is the intensive care, the physiotherapist there would be looking at, with their experience, spotting problems that could occur in the future. So for me, that would be a big one, would be preventing any contractures that are happening. So if you're on intensive care, the priority is obviously to preserve life at this stage. It is to create the best, I'm going to use you as an example, the best brook to be able to work on in the future. So we need to make sure that all your limbs are moving, that you've got the range of movement in all your limbs, so that later on there's something to work with. Because if you're really contracted at that stage, there's a lot of undoing.
Yeah. Just explain for the benefit of our listeners, when you say contractures. Yeah,
I was going to say, explain for me as well.
Yeah, so contractures would be a soft tissue shortening. So a good example would be, it doesn't work very well on an audio podcast, but if I was bending my elbow, my biceps muscle, if I kept my elbow in that position, my biceps muscle would shorten in that position. Mm-hmm. So over a period of time, then straightening your elbow would be difficult. So that's right. A really simple, simple idea. But where we find it most commonly after neurological damage is in the calf muscle. So if the calf, especially if someone's been lay on the back, they may have been ventilated, and the toes are pointing down to the bottom of the bed.
The calf has
been in a shorter position for a long period of time. If you then start looking at sitting, standing, walking in the future, if you've got a really short calf, your heel's not going to touch the floor.
Yeah.
So you can prevent those problems, or aim to prevent those problems. Initially, after a brain injury, you often have a period of what we call flaccidity, or where the muscles are very floppy.
Mm-hmm.
But over a period of time, as you have to do more and the demands on you are more, that floppiness or flaccidity changes to being high tone. So it becomes tight. So rather than the muscle being floppy, they become tight. And that's where you can potentially get contractures at that stage.
So I guess the important thing is like early intervention to keep things moving rather than wait for it to become a problem and then try and resolve it.
Yeah, so we're at that stage, we'd use stretches. So it might be that your physio or the carers or the staff are doing quite a range of stretches, even before someone's conscious.
Mm.
It may be that you have to use splinting. So that would be where a device is put on you or cast on you, where like it could be a plaster of Paris kind of cast. Uh-huh. They're not quite a plaster of Paris, but that kind of thing that keeps your foot in a good position.
Okay.
Yeah, so it stops your toes pointing down to the floor. It stops your calf muscle tightening. And also in your arms, on your elbows, it may be that you have splints to keep your arms straight at that point. Really important for the future.
So what happens then if the muscles go hard?
If the muscles go hard and if they go tight, it can be quite difficult to undo.
Right.
It's much easier to prevent than it is to sort out later on. But if your muscles are tight and if it has gone from a tightness through to a contracture, which is something that doesn't move, it's kind of stuck.
Is that like permanent then?
Yeah, but there are ways of dealing with that in the subacute and chronic stage. So it would be things like, you might have heard of botulinum toxin injections. Botox. Yeah, Botox, but a bit higher doses injected into the muscles to relax the muscles. Okay. and you would use that in terms in conjunction with splinting,
yeah,
like we were saying, where you put a device on to give the that joint a stretch. It would be positioning as well, so trying to avoid it happening in the first place. Sometimes, and we have some clients who have to have surgery in the future, but that has its complications and it has its pros and cons. So what do you remember, Brooke, about the really early days after your injury?
Not a right lot, to be quite honest, but I tend to lean on my parents and stuff because they've got all the memories of it. They were talking to me, and my sister was saying as well that the physios came in when I was actually still in a coma and did quite a bit of work with me there. I'm not sure what they were doing, but I guess to prevent me just laying there and having no ascension.
Yeah, that would be really good practice, that if they were coming in doing stretches, making sure you're positioned right, and perhaps telling your parents, you know, if they could help. Because it's quite a nice thing at that stage to be able to ask relatives to be involved, because what else can they do? They feel quite helpless.
Yeah, I think it was quite traumatising for my mum because I was still in a coma when they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you think they were doing, just stretching my muscles.
Yeah. So sometimes it can be quite painful, and some people who come out of coma remember some of the pain of the stretches.
Right.
Rather than, that's good. Yeah, physios would have been coming at least daily.
Yeah, all the stories that you have people remembering what's happened in the coma, and they can see a white light and all that, but I can't remember anything.
Nothing that dramatic,
nothing
was it?
Probably just as well.
But more, or quite often you'll hear someone saying the first thing they remembered. I saw someone yesterday, and the first thing they remembered was 3 months after their injury, and they woke up in the rehab centre.
That's pretty much exactly what I remember, yeah, about 3 months after, yeah.
So you were saying in the acute phase you look at management of, you know, making sure that the muscles are being used and stretched and so on to avoid contractures. Are there any other things that you would be doing at that stage, or is that kind of the main priority?
No, you'd also, it depends on the unit, but sometimes you'd be looking after respiratory function.
Mm.
So if someone's being ventilated, you'd be involved in the kind of breathing exercises, perhaps some suction, working alongside the intensive care nurses in terms of maintaining airways.
And just explain why suction is important for our listeners, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, when you are being ventilated, in it, especially quite often after an injury, you may have broken some ribs.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be difficult for you to take those deep breaths, especially some of the lower rib fractures. So it tends to be that the bottom of your lungs get full of rubbish at this point. So yeah, the top part of your lungs are getting aerated well up here, but the bottom can get a bit of gunk on there. So
technical term.
A technical term. You get sputum on there, which...
Yeah, we'll go with
that. Yeah. But then you need to be able to get rid of that because it makes your lungs much less effective.
Yeah.
In the
and I suppose
term.
There's also, it's managing risks of chest infections.
Yeah, and that's where the dietitians come in as well, and the speech and language therapist in terms of managing, it's a little bit later on, but managing diet, because at this stage you may have a problem with your swallow.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that if you're taking any oral diet, that it's going down the wrong tube.
Yeah.
Right.
So you don't want that lying on your lungs.
Yeah.
So suction sometimes we would use to get rid of that stuff while you're still asleep on the ventilator.
It's quite grim, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
So after you treated a patient in the acute phase, how would the physio journey change in the subacute phase?
Yeah, so in the subacute, so I would say that's when you're out of kind of medical danger. So when you're, and you, like you said, you start to develop more of a consciousness of where you are, of what's going on, of what's happened to you, and... You're, at this stage, you would often be still looked after. So you still are being transferred. This is probably the time where you start to remember things.
Mm.
So you may be having to be hoisted, you know, from the bed to a chair. You may be unable to sit. So we'd work on how you do those transfers, how you sit, how you stand, how you do that transfer from bed to chair, bed to toilet. And those kind of things are really important at that stage. And it's quite often, I would say, the probably heaviest workload for a physiotherapist in terms of manual handling.
Mm.
This job, because you may have very little active movement to keep yourself sat up. Right. And you may get fatigued very quickly in terms of if you sat out in the chair, it might be for 10 minutes, and that's enough to be able to go back to bed. This probably seems a long time where...
I do have sort of memory of that, when people were saying, you know, don't walk and stuff. And I was like, I think I was just confused at the time. Like, what are they talking about? I can't walk. Of course I can walk. And I walked, which this is not, again, not good for audio, but I walked to like the corner of the room where there was, those hospital chairs. And I sort of walked, which would probably be about 10 paces. And it was waddling, just sort of staggered. And more or less collapsed in the chair. And being absolutely exhausted from doing that.
Mm-hmm. So was that a positive experience?
I think it was, yeah. You just didn't really understand, like, why I was... I mean, because I was... Luckily, I got into the gym before my accident, and I still had sort of memories of that. I thought I'd be, I thought I was as strong as I was, and I suppose it was like a big element of shock that I wasn't. And people were telling me, be careful, and, I didn't really like to be told that. And I just, in sort of frustration, I got up and walked, and I just remember having to, go to bed after that, because it was just so exhausting.
You brought up some really good points there, because there will have been quite a lot of work that happened before that memory. Before your memory there. So you've already described that you were sat in a chair, that you were able to get out of a chair, that you were able to stand up, that you were able to move across.
Right, okay.
So there would have been work on how did you sit? How did you manage to get from the bed into the chair?
Mm. Right.
So there's all those parts of work prior to it.
I just don't remember, yeah.
But what's really interesting is that, as you've said there, I was told not to walk. Can you think why you were told not to walk at that
point? I just can't remember, really. I don't know if anybody specifically said to me, don't walk. I was just like, it was not, that might be my mum and dad, I don't know.
Because when I qualified, they used to say, we used to stop a lot of people walking right early on. You'd be saying, please don't do that, please don't. And it was because they weren't doing it perfect. So we didn't want bad movement patterns to be reproduced.
Yeah. Okay.
But we'd go around the ward saying, no, sit down, you. Sit down. Don't get up. You'll spoil everything that we've done. You just stay there. And obviously that's now realised that's an unrealistic expectation, that people have to, after hospital, have to go and live in the world and they'll do whatever they like.
Yeah.
So, but your safety may have been a prime concern there.
I'm sure it was, yeah. You just don't like to be told that you can't do something. I was 24 at the time, and, I didn't really understand. I remember people telling me what had happened to me, but just not really believing it, and thought there was not that they were lying to me, but they were just like, I just thought that they'd got the wrong end of the stick or something, and just not really understanding why I was in this hospital. Because I'm from a small town, Scarborough, and people say in hospital, so to me, I've only ever known one hospital, it was Scarborough Hospital. So I always assumed that I was in Scarborough Hospital. And they took me once downstairs outside in Hope Hospital, it was called then, but it's Salford Royal. And just being really confused and like...
You wonder where the sea had gone.
Yeah. And just like, what's going on here?
We're not in Scarborough anymore.
No, absolutely not. So
No, but that's... Why would you know where you are? Because... Probably a room in Scarborough Hospital would be very similar to a room. It's only when you go out there that the disappointment starts.
I had this memory of, because I was in hospital, I'd done this stupid thing. I'd jumped off a hay bale a couple of years before and I'd broken my ankle. And I spent the night in Scarborough Hospital. And I had it in my head that I was in the same room, or very sort of similar part of the building anyway, because to look out the window, I couldn't really see much. Mm. You could only really see the sky, so I just kind of assumed that I was in there. And then, to be taken outside was quite a shock to me. But, obviously pretend I'm not shocked and I was fine. But
that's a common kind of experience that you're saying about feeling that this either isn't happening to you or it's another... orthopedic kind of, I've just broke something, which we quite often have with clients, but we really have it quite a lot with relatives who think it's just something else that's broken. It's another broken leg. It will get better. And it might be that you've got broken bones and they will get better. But I try with our clients to reinforce quite early on that you will be different. Mm. This will always be different. It doesn't mean it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
But it will be a... We had Brooke 1 before the injury, and we've got Brooke 2 now.
I just didn't, just confusion, just didn't really understand what had happened. And obviously now I've, you know, got the benefit of hindsight of, you know, all that stuff I've learned about it and I've read about it and stuff. But then I just confused, and I just thought at first, you know, I'm visiting somebody in hospital, because I didn't really feel like anything was broken. Or anything, you know, I was obviously in no plaster, you know, plaster casts. And it was just the only thing I can describe it as a massively confusing time, with obviously pretending to know what's going on.
And this is the time where we get lots of falls.
Right.
Mm. So people think, no, I'm fine. Off we go.
Boom.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I could do that. Crash. You know, and because the very fact of someone having a lack of awareness means the attitude to risk is very different, because there's nothing wrong with me. So obviously I can go up and do this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a long journey to kind of accept what's happened.
Yeah.
I fell pretty badly in hospital, actually. In the middle of the night, I got up and I stood up on my bed. And obviously there's the bed guards, isn't they? But come to the side. And I tripped over the bed guard and I've fallen on my elbow, which luckily nothing was broken. But it's still a little bit dodgy now. But
you'd had 24 years of nothing being wrong.
Yeah.
To wake up one day and I'm not quite as mobile as I used to be, then your brain initially thinks, no, I can still do that. And that's why you have the accident.
I think what probably happened was I woke up and I went and needed the toilet, and there was these guards on, so I probably tried to climb over it. Looking back, that's probably what happened. But then again, I don't know what happened. So
yeah, that's really not uncommon. And often in this kind of subacute phase, moving into the longer term phase, the more mobile someone becomes, the more likely they are to fall.
Right.
Okay.
In that period, especially if someone has a poor insight or a poor awareness into their limitations.
Yeah.
So for some clients, it would appear that their condition actually deteriorates a little bit, or especially if they've got limited cognitive function, mm-hmm. if they're struggling to process the information around and they get mobile quite quickly,
mm-hmm.
it can cause all kinds of problems.
Yeah,
I can see that.
That you've got the ability, but you've not got the cognitive ability to know
again,
what to do
I
with
can
it.
See that now, but I didn't know that.
I guess fatigue also comes into it. You were saying, you know, you waddle those 10 paces.
I suffered badly from fatigue at first. I mean, I still do now 15 years later, but obviously to a much lesser extent. But yes, fatigue at first was horrific.
And I think the word horrific is about right, isn't it? Because it's, I think, differentiated between tiredness and fatigue.
Yeah, and add that to the frustration that nobody understands that you just... Particularly, it's more when you get out of hospital, isn't it? When you're in the hospital, you know, you're surrounded by people that know, and you obviously, you know, your activities there are planned, and you know, you do some one activity, you have a rest, and then when you come out of hospital, you've got no structure to your life, so you're just exhausted all the time.
I think people often people look forward to being discharged from hospital, it'll be brilliant when I'm home.
It'll be just like it was.
And when you get home, it especially if you go back to where you came from, you know, if you go back to your old place, and it's like, it's a slap in the face to say, look what you used to be.
Yeah.
And look what you can't do now. But fatigue can be split into two sections. It can be a kind of cognitive or a thinking fatigue.
Yeah.
And it can also be a physical fatigue. Could you explain how yours showed itself?
Well, I guess it was right before the incident. I was the fittest I've ever been in my life, and in the best shape, and which helped me make a good recovery. But I just remember there was the thinking fatigue that really got me. Obviously, my fitness had gone down, my strength had gone down. You're still in your head, you still think you're the same person, don't you? But obviously, I was quite, you know, physically strong before it, and I was, you know, physically fit as well. But all of a sudden, it was really the thinking fatigue, because just to concentrate on something, like even for 5 minutes, I couldn't follow anything on TV. I couldn't even just conversation, just everything, you know, all these things that come into your life, you know, you slowly realize what's happening, like slowly realize that the different light of a room would, I always equate it to like battery on a mobile phone. I suppose that was something that was in my life at the time, and it's in everybody's life now, isn't it? The more things that went on in my life, you know, Like, for instance, the room was poorly lit, you'd have to, you know, squint to see, and that would impact on your battery life. And if you could, you had to, there was other factors, like there was other external noise that would, you know, and you're having to filter out conversations, that would tire you out.
Yeah, because I don't think you realise just how much is going on.
No.
For you to be able to filter that out.
Yeah, or... this had come later, realising that. But obviously at first it was all hitting me. I didn't know what to avoid and what to look out for. So it was just, I was just getting flat out exhausted, and it was just tiredness that, you know, you try and understand, you try and explain it to people, and you just think that you're really physically fatigued. But the only thing I've ever could really liken it to was, if you've ever been awake for 24 hours for whatever reason, and then just trying to have a conversation, then you were just, it was just like that all the time.
Someone once described it to me, they could feel after a meeting, say after something like this, where they had to concentrate, that they felt like they'd been hit by a train.
Mm. Kind of, yeah.
It was so severe, and it wasn't I'm a bit tired.
Yeah.
Have a long, no, bang.
And people would say, just, you know, go and have a nap. But obviously, the thing with just going for a nap is there was obviously like so much stuff going on in my brain that I just couldn't rest.
Mm.
And that was, I remember that being a thing that I couldn't turn off, I couldn't rest. When I got to this flat in Scarborough, the first flat, I remember there was a Buddhist meditation group, and I thought Buddhist meditation, that, you know, an ability to calm my mind down, and that helped. But yeah, it was just, you know, you were so tired, but then you couldn't really rest neither, so it was just like a constant thing.
Sometimes the rest can be in other activities, so it could be, rather than trying to sleep, it could be I'll listen to some music, or I'll listen to an audio book, or I'll go sunbathing if you're in Scarborough.
Sunny Scarborough, it's always sunny in Scarborough.
But could you compare that with, did you experience any aspects of physical fatigue? Because you'll have known physical fatigue from your exercising and your gym.
I guess it was like just a mixture of both.
It's hard to differentiate sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, it's only, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and the benefit of accruing different, you know, knowledge about my condition. But at the time, I just didn't have a clue. So it just used to hit me full on, like I say, like a train.
I think that would be really useful for people listening to this who have got fatigue, because they kind of can and hear your lived experience of, you know, what does it feel like? Oh, I feel like that. And it's horrible.
It is, yeah.
But it can change as well.
Obviously, you know, it does change over time. You don't notice it changing, though. Well, with me anyway, my experience, it was changes that slow that you don't really... think you're any better. What tended to happen was, like, if I've not seen somebody for like a couple of months or something, they would always remark about how much better I was. But then in your head, you're just thinking, they're only just saying that to make me feel better. Yeah, you don't notice it yourself.
Someone gave a really good analogy one time. They said it's like a train journey from Manchester to London.
Yeah.
You get on the train in Manchester and it's pitch black. You get off the train at Euston and it's a beautiful sunny day, but you don't realise on that journey when the light started to go up.
Yeah.
But you can spot parts that probably when you're in Stoke, it was miserable. But as you got to Northampton, you know, you could see the sun coming up
and
by the time you get into London. So it's that kind of journey sometimes, isn't it? There's not one eureka moment where you're, ta-da!
And it's better now. It's obviously now it's immeasurably better than what it used to be, but it was pretty grim at the start. I think what helped was exercise. It helped. I was dead keen on exercise from the start, but that has its dangers as well, because I used to overdo it, always overdo it, and I used to just tie myself up more. You'd read these things about people exercising in the morning, and that's what I worked out that exercising in the morning was kind of the worst thing for me, because then that had kind of ruined my day, because I'd never really recovered from it.
Right. Quite often our work with clients is making exercise consistent, reliable, not over demanding, that it's something you want to go back to. Because we've all done the thing, haven't we? We eat too many mince pies at Christmas, and then January we're going to go for it.
Full on, mentally, yeah.
You join the gym, and then by mid-January the gym's empty.
Exactly.
All manageable changes rather than big changes.
Yeah.
We had a client very recently, and we said, right, what are we going to do? He said, I'm going to go to the gym 5 days a week. Alarm bells immediately start ringing, because the 1 week that he doesn't go five times
then it's
week
ruined.
After, he'll probably not go at all.
Yeah, I found that to do, well, if you do something, step counters, that's really good. If you go in for a certain amount of steps in a day, that's really good. It's something that you can, you know, you can keep your eye on, Kai. But I found that like doing something every other day is good because you've got that recovery day.
And from a training point of view, rest days are just as useful as exercise days.
Yeah.
So I think to get that pattern in, and as a physiotherapist, if we can kind of say you do need those rests, and fatigue diaries can be really helpful.
Yeah.
So we can plot, right, what have you done? What's your fatigue been? So you can you could put it on a battery level, or you could do it on a traffic light system and see, you know, where your fatigue's going. And we can look at it. In fact, we did this with a client who was an ex-professional golfer, and his fatigue was terrible. And he said to me not so long ago, he said, Colin, can you believe how bad his fatigue was? He would do one thing. He might do 10 balls at the driving range, and then he'd sleep for 2 days.
Oh, wow.
But now he'll go all over the place. He'll play golf all over the place, and he's fine. He said, I can't believe how fatigued I was in the past.
Yeah.
And over 5 years, where I am now.
That's a good point, actually, because to sleep for 2 days, it really is that bad, and people don't really get it.
And that there doesn't look often to be anything wrong.
Nah.
So especially if someone's going back into employment, if they're going back into education or back into family life, the family can be, well, you're doing all right. You're walking, you're moving, you're doing a bit of exercise. Off we go. We'll go on a holiday.
Oh, yeah.
Going on the holiday might be sound good, but it might be the most stressful.
Yeah, and fatiguing. Very cognitively demanding
as
well.
And stuff that goes on in your head as well. What are they thinking about me? Are they onto me? Are they... what do they think? You know, I think I'm weak.
Yeah, so fatigue is a really crucial thing.
Yeah.
That's a useful diversion, I think, that we've got.
Thank you for listening to part one. We hope you can join us for part two. Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.